I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish, and what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven, under the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labor. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head while the fool walks in the darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. And then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. What then do I gain by being wise? I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless. A chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool. Yet he will have control over all the work into which I've poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What does a man get for the toil and anxious striving with which he labors under the sun all his days, his work, his pain and grief? Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. And this too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. And this too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. What's the most dangerous word in the English language? What do you think it would be if you had to vote for the most poisonous, toxic word in the English language that's done more harm and pain and anxiety to human beings? What would it be, I wonder? My suggestion is the word if. If. It's just two words, looks harmless enough. but it can be incredibly toxic. If can crush your spirit with thoughts of what might be, if only things were different, if only I'd said this, if only I'd done that, if only I had more money, if only I could be famous, if only I could be more attractive, if only I could be married, or if you're married, if only I could be single. Last week on Twitter, "My life would be complete if" started trending. Here's what people said on Twitter. "My life would be complete if I never had to worry about money. If I could eat all day and never get fat. If my hair and makeup magically did itself every morning. If I could accomplish every goal I'm working towards. If there was no more bullying. If my painful memories came with a delete button." And then there were lots of tweets about life being complete if only they could marry Justin Bieber or Rihanna, or ideally both. That word if keeps many of us on a lifelong treadmill of discontent, running after things but never getting the satisfaction we want. It's like the search for the end of the rainbow. It's a mist, it's a mirage, it's an itch we can't scratch, it's a phantom limb. If only we were richer or cleverer or luckier in love. We see the carefully vetted and posed pictures of happy couples in our Facebook feed and we think, look at those happy couples, look at them being happy. Look at them. Look at them. If I had what they've got, then I'd be happy. Then I'd be happy. Then I'd be able to stop searching for satisfaction. Meanwhile, the happy couple themselves are looking at their Facebook feed and thinking exactly the same thing. Why? Why do we stay on this treadmill of dissatisfaction? Even when we get the things we want, why do we stay on it? I want to suggest that it's because even when we get those things, we find that they don't give us the satisfaction we thought they would. And we assume it's because we don't have enough of those things. Or maybe it's because we need something else. So we stay on the treadmill. If, what if, what if? What if I had that? If never ends. If is exhausting. It drives us to live lives of quiet desperation. It's like being stalked by the world's most obnoxious personal trainer, just barking orders at us all day. He slaps us awake in the morning, and he doesn't stop shouting until finally we collapse unconscious at night. If you want to be happy, work harder, play harder, try harder, search harder. If that treadmill sounds familiar, Ecclesiastes chapter 2 is written for you. It's written by the teacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem, which many of us seem to be King Solomon himself, the man who could never say, if only I had just this one more thing, because he already had it. He was the man who had everything. He had unlimited resources at his disposal, as we'll see, and he set himself the task of searching for satisfaction. And he's saying to us this morning, I want to tell you what I discovered, so you do not wreck yourself on the treadmill of if. So three headings as we look at chapter 2. Number one, the search for satisfaction in pleasure. That's verses 1 to 11. Number 2, the search for satisfaction in wisdom. Verses 12 to 16. And number 3, the search for satisfaction in work, verses 17 to 24. So firstly, the search for satisfaction in pleasure, verses 1 to 11. Just look at chapter 2, verse 1. I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. So Solomon's saying, right, let's see if pleasure really can satisfy. And he gives us the short answer in verses 1 and 2. Verses 1 and 2, but pleasure also proved to be meaningless. Reuben talked about that word last week, meaningless. We see it about 30 times in Ecclesiastes. Literally, it means vapor. It's like your breath on a frosty morning. You see it, but only for a second. It's gone. It's impossible to hang on to. Pleasures like that, according to the man who has everything. Verse 2, laughter, I said, is madness. And what does pleasure accomplish? There is something mad about laughter and pleasure, he says. It's like we're all on the deck of the Titanic. We know we're going down, and we're all standing around cracking jokes. There's something mad about it. So he says, laughter and earthly pleasures don't give us the lasting satisfaction we want. That's the short answer. That's the short answer from Ecclesiastes chapter 2. No, pleasure doesn't give lasting satisfaction. But he's wiser than that, Solomon. He knows that we don't really believe him. He knows we don't really believe him. And even as we read that, pleasure is meaningless, we are thinking, mate, you must have been doing something wrong. You must have been doing something wrong. If I had what you had, I'd be happy. So Solomon says, okay, let me show you how far I went in the pursuit of pleasure. And then he reels off this list, verses 3 to 10, of all the pleasures he pursued in the quest for satisfaction. And it is dizzying. Here's the first one, verse 3, alcohol. We think to ourselves, come on, Solomon, if life was one long party, if only life was one long party, it'd be great. Then I'd be satisfied. Well, Solomon's already been there and done that. He says, tonight I'm going to party like it's 1999 BC. Verse 3, I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. He's been there and he's done it. Verse 4, I'd be satisfied if only I had a nicer home. More property, holiday villas, beautiful architecture, land, penthouses, mansions. I'd be satisfied if only I could have my own apartment and if I wasn't sharing. If only I owned a house rather than just renting a flat. If only I wasn't still living with my parents, then I'd be satisfied. Have you felt the power of that particular if? Solomon's already ahead of you. Verse 4, I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself. And just to say, he was no amateur, Solomon. He oversaw the building of God's house, the temple. It took 7 years and 153,000 people to build it. And then he took 13 years to get his own palace just the way he wanted it. 13 years. Imagine what you would build. 13 years, unlimited resources. What would you build? That's what he does. Verse 5, I'd be satisfied if I had wide open spaces filled with beautiful plants and trees and fountains, a place that I could go to escape. You know, where no one would bother me, where I could be alone, an oasis where there was nothing but the sound of birds and the whispering of wind in the treetops, no traffic, no litter, no noisy neighbours, then I'd be satisfied. Solomon does that too. Verse 5, I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. Gardens very significant in the Bible, of course. This almost sounds like an attempt by Solomon to return to Eden. Maybe you can relate to that desire. If only things were the way they used to be. Before things got messed up. Before things went wrong. In that sense, gardens feel like returning home. We think to ourselves, if I could just have a place like that, then I'd be satisfied. Verse 7, if only I had more time to myself. Have you felt the power of that particular if? If only I didn't have to work, then I would be happy. More leisure time. If only I had more time to do what I want to do. If only I had slaves to do my bidding. Minions. Verse 7, I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. Solomon says, yep, I tried that. I tried that. I never had to lift a finger if I didn't want to. Verse 7 continued. Okay, Solomon, but I'd be satisfied if I had more stuff. A cooler car, a faster computer, a bigger TV, more things designed by Apple. Or what if I had more pets? I love pets. I love animals. More animals, then I'd be happy. How many of you women, when you were a little girl, said, Jesus, just give me a pony. Just give me the pony, then I'll be happy. Verse 7, Solomon's already there. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. He owned more stuff than anyone. Verse 8, if I had more money, I'd be satisfied. Wouldn't it be great to be rich? Wouldn't it be great? Never have to worry about your outgoings. You could ask for cash back in the co-op and you could just walk out with a wheelbarrow full of it. It'd be great, wouldn't it? Or just buy the co-op, of course. You could just buy the co-op and then buy all the other supermarkets so you had no competition and everybody in the world had to buy everything at the co-op.
You could always afford whatever you wanted, whenever you wanted. Well, Solomon got there already. Verse 8, I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. Just from the taxes he collected, Solomon got 25 tons of gold every year. And that doesn't even include the revenue from land, investments, treasure that was brought in from around the world on his fleet of ships, and from the kings and queens that visited him and tried to suck up to him by giving him incredibly expensive gifts. He was loaded. He was absolutely loaded. Do you know what he used to call the change down the back of his sofa? A rollover jackpot. Verse 8, music and the arts. Music and the arts, aesthetic pleasure. If only I could be surrounded by my favourite music and art wherever I go. I don't mean being able to buy Mumford & Sons MP3s for the rest of my life. I mean owning Mumford & Sons. Owning them. Not just Mumford, but also his sons, right? I want the whole family in my massive house, by my massive swimming pool, playing for an audience of me. By the way, I take research very seriously. I use the internet to find out exactly what Mumford & Sons would cost. They said you can hire them for an evening for £35,000. And I said, yeah, but how much for them? Actually, for them. I want to buy them. They haven't got back to me yet. So anyway, this was child's play for Solomon. Verse 8, I acquired male and female singers. His own personal living iPod. Anytime, anywhere, live music, whatever he wanted. End of verse 8, you knew we'd get there in the end. Sex. If I could sleep with whoever I wanted, whenever I wanted, then I'd be satisfied. Blonde, brunette, redhead, fat, thin, young, old, it doesn't matter. Solomon had that. Verse 8, I acquired a harem as well, the delights of a man's heart. Do you remember how many wives Solomon had? 700. 700. And do you remember how many girlfriends he had? Concubines? 300. 300 girlfriends he had. You say, I'd be happy with one. Every date night, he has to charter an entire fleet of minibuses. Can you imagine? You know, they're queued round the block at Nando's. This is just bonkers. What this means is that every sexual desire he has is immediately met by the most beautiful women on the planet. Some men get addicted to pornography because of this particular if. What if I could sleep with anyone, anytime? Then I'd be satisfied. Because what is pornography? What is it? It's a fake, pixelated, 2D attempt to have Solomon's harem. That's what it is. It's a virtual parade of all kinds of women available on demand, anytime. And when it doesn't satisfy, the amazing thing is, we think to ourselves, yeah, but if they were real, then I'd be satisfied. Then I'd be satisfied. And of course, it's not just an issue for blokes. Men and women often think to themselves, if only I had that in real life. Unlimited partners, one for every mood. Then I'd be satisfied. I would, I'd be satisfied, honestly. Well, Solomon tried it. He had it. For real. And we'll get his verdict in a minute. Verse 9. Lastly, if only I were more powerful, more respected and admired and feared. I wouldn't have a boss. I would be the boss. Do you know that if? You felt that if? Solomon's already ahead of us. Verse 9, I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. He was so great that when the Queen of Sheba comes to visit in 1 Kings 10, and the Queen of Sheba, by the way, she was no slouch herself. Fabulously wealthy. She comes to visit Solomon in 1 Kings 10. Do you know what it says? It says that when she saw all that Solomon was and all that he'd accomplished, she had no more breath in her. She was breathless because he was awesome, absolutely staggering. And then finally in verse 10, Solomon sums up his search for satisfaction in pleasure. Verse 10. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired, nothing. I refused my heart no pleasure. And then notice what he says next. You see, Solomon is a realist. He says, there is delight to be taken, if only briefly, in these things. Verse 10, my heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. And yet, you knew it was coming. And there it is in verse 11. Yet, this is the moment of truth for all our if-onlys. This is the moment of truth. Because Solomon's been there and done that, and this is where it leaves him. This is where you and I would end up if our wildest dreams suddenly became reality. Verse 11. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I'd toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. In other words, all this pleasure, all of it, all of this pleasure, you know, even the Mumford and Sons, the naked women, all of it, it's a vapor. It's like steam from a kettle. It just dissipates into nothing. Nothing. That's the ultimate problem with seeking pleasure in all the places Solomon mentions. It just does not last. Well, okay, we say, yeah, so it doesn't last. Big deal. What's wrong with just getting more of it? Anyway, what's wrong with arranging the fleeting pleasures end to end like dominoes so that life becomes one long constant pleasure? What about if we do that? But of course, it doesn't work that way, does it? Trying to put one pleasure immediately after another soon becomes monotonous for us. We are one of the richest, best educated, most pleasure-seeking cultures on the planet. We have more free time than any other civilization in history, and we are more bored and depressed than we have ever been. Stress-related illnesses are through the roof. We eat unhappiness for breakfast. Also, as we know from our own experiments, let alone Solomon's, the more we get of pleasure, the less it satisfies. We're like drug addicts, endlessly trying to recapture that first high, needing to increase the dosage again and again to get the same level of pleasure. And not only that, but many people have noticed something called the hedonistic fallacy. The hedonist says, just pursue pleasure. That's what life's about, pursue pleasure. That's the way to live. The problem is you cannot pursue pleasure directly. You cannot go after pleasure itself, because pleasure is something that happens incidentally when we're doing something else. So, you know, we drink a cold beer, we read a great book, we enjoy a wonderful view, and then somehow if it works out well, we get pleasure from that. But you can't go after pleasure itself. All of which makes pleasure extremely slippery. Impossibly hard to keep hold of. And that's what drives the teacher here to say that it's meaningless. It's a vapor. It's like when you were a kid and you hoped that by stepping on a shadow, you could trap it. It's chasing after the wind. It's exhausting and it's fruitless. And the question is, do you believe that? Or do you prefer to stay on the treadmill of the word if? If Solomon, of all people in history, could return from his research with that verdict, what hope do we have of finding satisfaction in worldly pleasures? What hope do we have? What about searching for satisfaction in wisdom and folly? That's our second heading, verses 12 to 16, very briefly this time. We've already seen the beginning of this search for wisdom last week in chapter 1, 12 to 16, and Solomon's conclusion here in chapter 2 is the same, with one extra wrinkle. Verse 13, wisdom, he says, is better than folly. It is better, just as light is better than darkness. So wisdom is to be desired. But ultimately, verse 14, the same fate overtakes them both. Verse 16, like the fool, the wise too must die. If everyone dies anyway and everyone's forgotten, from the Oxford Don to a homeless man ranting incoherently on the street, what difference does wisdom make? Ultimately none, because it has no answer to death. None. Verse 16, for the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. And the question is, do we believe that? Or do we stay on the treadmill thinking that if only we could be cleverer than everyone else, sharper, better educated, more insightful, wiser, then we'd be satisfied? If a king whose name has become synonymous with wisdom says that it's made meaningless by death, what hope do we have in finding lasting satisfaction there? And then lastly, the search for satisfaction in work, verses 17 to 26. A few years back, the NME magazine interviewed Thom Yorke, the frontman of the band Radiohead. Millions of records sold, worshipped by fans, you know, he's a critical darling, people adore him. And in this interview, Yorke asked himself, what's the point of being ambitious in his work? And he said, what for? I thought when I got to where I wanted to be, everything would be different. I thought I'd be somewhere else. I thought it'd all be white, fluffy clouds. And then I got there. And I'm still here. And the interviewer said, so what's the point? What's the point of carrying on? He says, it's filling the hole. It's just filling the hole. That's all anyone does. Then the interviewer said to him, what happens to the hole? And there was a long pause, and then he answered, it's still there. Or to put it another way, verse 17, all of it is meaningless. A chasing after the wind. It's also meaningless because verse 18, you cannot take it with you. It gets left to the next generation. They get the benefit of your work and skill. And verse 19, who knows what they'll do with it? If death always takes away from us all that we work for, then verse 22, what's the point of all that sweating and toiling? The theologian Derek Kidner puts it like this: if every card in our hand will be trumped, what does it matter how we play? What does it matter what strategy we have? Every card is going to lose. We're going to lose. But then, finally, in the last three verses, Solomon shines a glimmer of hope, just a glimmer, in our search for satisfaction. We're going to see it expanded as we look at the rest of Ecclesiastes, but here it is, just a glimmer. Verse 24, a person can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in their own toil. In other words, whatever satisfaction you receive from pleasure or wisdom or work, understand its limitations, because you will enjoy it much more if you do. Understand that earthly satisfaction is not eternal. It is not meant to be. So do not try to cling on to it as if it were the whole point of life. Enjoy it for what it is, a temporal blessing, verse 24, given by the hand of our Maker. See, one of the things that spoils our pleasures is our hunger to get out of them more than they can give. They weren't designed to bring ultimate satisfaction. They were designed to point towards someone who can. The disillusionment that we feel when pleasure fades is intentional. It is intended to make us seek the only lasting source of all pleasure. You see, it doesn't matter how much stuff we have. It doesn't matter how much cash or sex or property or holidays, because none of that addresses the root of our discontent, which is our broken relationship with the source of all satisfaction. Verse 24, this too I see is from the hand of God, for without him who can eat or find enjoyment? If our search for satisfaction just ignores God, then we're like the thirsty man tearing around trying to catch raindrops on his tongue when there's a beautiful clear stream flowing right at his feet. Without God, even the rich man in his palace is miserable. It's why so many lottery winners say, you know, I wish I'd never won. I wish I'd never won. But with God, even the poor man in prison can sing for joy. Just ask the Apostle Paul. Writing from prison in Rome, he says, I've learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through Christ, who gives me strength. You see, Solomon was a wise man, but the ultimate wise man of Scripture is Jesus Christ. King Solomon could not die to bring his people satisfaction, even if he wanted to. But King Jesus can. King Jesus did. We all of us have pushed our Maker away, madly believing that somehow we could find satisfaction apart from the Creator of all satisfaction. It's madness. And we deserve God's condemnation for that. We deserve it. But God's Son took the punishment we deserve. By his death and resurrection, Jesus Christ made it possible for us to be reconciled to the Father of all satisfaction. He made it possible. As Solomon discovered, that doesn't mean we can enjoy perfect satisfaction in this life. That's got to wait for the new creation. But in the meantime, there is lasting satisfaction to be found in Jesus. Psalm 16 tells us that it's only our Maker's presence which can fill us with joy. It's only this God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, who can give pleasures which last eternally. And it's only Jesus Christ who can reunite us with this joy-filled, joy-giving God. Verse 26, God alone is the one who gives lasting wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. We look for happiness in our parties, our houses, our leisure time, our possessions, our money, our sex, our power, our wisdom, our work, and we treat those things as if they're the very best hope we have for satisfaction. As C.S. Lewis says, we're far too easily pleased. We're far too easily pleased. We fool about with drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is being offered us in Jesus Christ. We're like a child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a beautiful holiday at the sea. Searching for satisfaction is not the problem. We are made for that search. The problem is that we are far too easily satisfied. So often we seek satisfaction in all the wrong places. My friend, if this morning you cannot imagine the deep, lasting satisfaction that Jesus Christ is offering you, pray that he would open your eyes to see it. Whether you consider yourself a follower of Jesus or not, ask him this morning to end your treadmill search for satisfaction. Ask him to end that weary search in him. Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, we confess that we have searched for pleasure, satisfaction, joy in all the wrong places. Our quest for fulfillment should have taken us towards you, but it has taken us away from you. And we confess that we have done what is evil in your sight. We've treated you as if you were worthless, as if you knew nothing about pleasure, as if you knew nothing about joy and satisfaction. Father, thank you for sending us the most precious gift of all, which dwarfs all others. Thank you for sending the gift of your Son so that we could know that satisfaction forever, so that we could be forgiven for the way that we've treated you. Father, this morning, for all of us, I pray that you'd open the eyes of our hearts to see how precious Jesus is, how satisfying Jesus is, how fulfilling he is. Let us be satisfied in him, and let us not be satisfied in anything less. We ask this in his beautiful name. Amen.